Welcome back to the podcast, Deconstructing Alpha. I'm your host, Jeremy Van Arkel. And I've been waiting a long time to do a timely, insightful, value investing podcast here. And today's guest is Rich Pezina. So I'm super excited about this. Rich is the founder of Pezina Investment Management. They manage separate accounts and mutual funds. He is an industry icon when it comes to value investing. He's been an investment manager for 40 years, and he's one of our independent experienced specialist managers that we favor. This podcast really just was fantastic to record. Rich is just a great personality, a wealth of experience. And it's just, there's such a difference when you're interviewing somebody that is, they own the company, they have been an investment manager for 40 years, and they are free to talk about how things really are. And so this conversation was fun. It was spirited, and we jumped right into it. And so we're going to jump right into a discussion about sort of the imbalance in the marketplace right now and the difficulties with value investing. And so I appreciate everybody being here and listening. Before we start, just remember that to stay on to the end of the call for our important notes and disclosures. But without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Rich Pezina, founder of Pezina Investment Management. Rich, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad that you're here.
Thanks. Glad to do this.
Excellent. So I think timing has something to do with investing. And I think this is a real opportune time to talk about value investing. I mean, do you guys feel that way right now?
Well, look, I've been on the receiving end of questions that are not as nice as the way you put it. They would be more like, how can you keep doing that when it sucks so badly?
That's a technical term, right?
and it's really interesting because it actually hasn't been that bad. That's the amazing part, because if you look at the last 10 years that people can point to for value underperforming the S&P 500, it's actually not because value has done poorly. Value has done what it has always done. We've made double-digit returns. If I was sitting here 10 years ago and saying to you, invest in our value strategy, we'll produce double-digit returns, you would have said, sign me up, but I don't even really believe that you could do that.
And then
when we did it, you would be mad at us.
That's a strange condition, right? So right. I think we're all in a situation where we're actually are experiencing pretty good returns. They're just not as good as something else.
Correct.
And investors.
But nobody wants to examine that the something else is what's wrong. They like to examine that that's obvious because anybody can just do the S&P 500. So all the other things must be wrong. But, history suggests that buying the companies that everybody wants is generally a bad investment strategy. It hasn't been for the last 10 years, for sure, but we've got valuations that have moved into the stratosphere. And not only NVIDIA. I mean, NVIDIA is the harder one to analyze because you can make anything up about the future that you want to make up and justify your investment. But let's take one that almost everybody owns, like Microsoft. Try and do arithmetic on Microsoft. What do you have to assume to pay $3 trillion to buy a company that does $240 million in business and makes under $100 million? So, and by the way, more than half the business is their legacy Windows and Office. It's not something growing at 25% a year. Now, those are good businesses. I don't mean to downplay them. And the cloud business is a spectacular business. But the arithmetic you have, if I wanted to make 10% annualized return, writing a $3 trillion check for for Microsoft, I would have to make assumptions that are probably not reasonable. Meaning I have to get that the growth rate has to be so large that the cloud business will grow to be more than 100% of all IT spend 15 years from now. So it's just not possible unless you think that IT spend somehow companies all of a sudden have trillions of dollars to throw at this. And I know that's what people think, but that's not what has happened. What's happened is people spend on IT because it gives them efficiencies, and the actual dollars spent on IT growth rate hasn't been that high, hasn't been much more than the growth rate in global GDP. It's just that what you get for that has gotten more and more and more. But the dollars, you know, you're making stuff up to be able to get to a $3 trillion valuation.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad we started. We just dove right here in here at the Mag 7. I think if you're a professional money manager today, the frustration is not how well your portfolio has performed. It's that the frame of reference is that we need to outperform 7 stocks. And so to put this in what I've been doing with some of our clients is to put this in a frame of reference that is a little bit removed from the situation today. Is so that they don't get caught in the, oh, but AI is going to change the world. Or, oh, but the cloud computing is the greatest thing ever. But Microsoft's the greatest company ever. To get them to sort of anchor themselves a little bit more in it from a larger view, I've been talking about the late 1990s. And so you started your firm in 1996, and that must have been a pretty interesting time to start a value firm.
Interesting is a good word.
Yeah. So do you see any parallels today between 1999, late 90s?
There's some parallels and there are some differences. I mean, I'll tell you, we were in business for about 4 years, so it'll put us into 1999. And I probably had the most memorable client interchange that I've ever had in my life. A woman walked into my office and sat down and said, "My grandmother's a better investor than you are. All you have to do is buy Cisco. Everybody in the world has figured this out except for you." So I said, "Well, look, I did the Microsoft kind of thing. I said, Cisco, which was $500 billion, just put it in that context.
Yeah,
company had never hit $500 billion before. And you have been used to making 15% a year. To make if I wrote the check to buy the whole company for $500 billion, to make 15% a year, Cisco would have to earn $75 billion a year, and they earn $1 billion a year. Don't you think there's something wrong with that?" And she looked at me and said, "You just don't get it, do you?" To which I agreed. And by the way, at the time, you could buy any Western manufacturing company, just an industrial basic thing that broadly categorized as Western manufacturing, for 5x earnings, because Western manufacturing was dead. Everything was moving to Asia. The Asian currencies had collapsed, making even more advantageous, and will fulfill via the internet. And so the market was saying these companies are going away. That's basically what the market was saying.
Right.
You'd go and visit the companies that were supposedly going away, and their CEOs would tell you, "We're not going to lose any business." Okay. I mean, this is how extreme it was.
Yeah.
You have to understand why people buy our products. They buy our products because there's a 50-year or 100-year history of quality and reliability and service. And, you know, we're instrumental in their manufacturing process. So our salespeople are in their factories. Our service guys are there to fix something if it breaks. What am I going to do at the time it was Taiwan, if I was going to order my $5 part from Taiwan to save me $2 and then have it break. And and then I try and get online to get another one, and it's coming in 3 weeks. But the most important thing that he said was, and if it really does matter, that the $2 really does matter to people, we can make it in Taiwan too. There's nothing strategic about making it in Taiwan. So we loaded up in the late 90s in these industrial cyclicals. And when it unwound, and by the way, just unwound, it's not like you can point to an event. The market just ended for the internet bubble. And when it did, Cisco went from 500 billion to 100 billion, where it stayed for the next 20 years, rough, give or take, and earned what it should have earned for a $100 billion company. Did great, right? It was the backbone of the internet, just like the cloud is the backbone of AI. That's the same. Yeah. And what's different, though, is Cisco is 500 times earnings, and Microsoft is 40 times earnings.
Right, so the magnitude was different.
The magnitude was different, but the scale was so much more enormous that you already have a $240 billion business in Microsoft. To grow that 20% a year or 15% a year, you have to create $30 billion of new revenue every year. That is not trivial.
That's right. So at some point you get so large, you just simply can't really grow anymore.
Right.
So you said so much in that statement, right? And I was managing money in the late 1990s too, and people were very upset with us for making the money, but not enough money. And it was a very frustrating time. And so then when the market unraveled, you said it wasn't any event. It just slowly shifted.
Well, it wasn't slowly. It suddenly, on March 9th of 2000, the market changed its mind and then went straight down for 9 months. I can't point to what happened in the macro environment or in any specific company.
Yeah.
It just collapsed.
Yeah, and it just sort of fell under its own weight. And then we had a whole different environment, leadership change coming out of that. And I recall that value stocks performed very well after 1999. And during that decline, was it true that a lot of areas of the market, the more value areas of the market, actually made money?
Oh, yeah. The stocks that we had bought at five times earnings were doubles and triples and quadruples over the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
We saw, I'll tell you, you start a firm and 5 years into it, because in 98 and 99, we were zero return in 98 and 99, and the market was up 30 in each of those years. So to be 60 percentage points behind the S&P 500 as a new startup firm, you just figure that's it. We tried. Let's go get jobs somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
And 9 months later, we were ahead of the S&P 500.
That's what I think is really missing here with people. And they say one of the narratives is, how are you ever going to catch back up? And first of all, I don't know if anybody needs to catch back up.
Right.
Because if you're making positive returns, you're making positive returns. But I don't think people have today an understanding of how dramatic the shift can be when it occurs.
Yeah. Well, look, when you would have thought that we had some catalyst that would make this happen, right? I mean, even just looking at the first quarter of 2024, where interest rates started going back up again, we have like a steady increase in rates from throughout the whole quarter, just straight up. Inflation is not under control. The economy is not in a slow, soft landing situation. The earnings growth rates, even Microsoft, the earnings growth rates forecast for people for the next 5 years is lower than it was for the last 5 years. You have all of these things And you would think that can't be good for long duration growth stocks where discount rate matters.
Exactly. It's interesting because that narrative, you know, so, you know, the macro people, they just want to make up a narrative for everything. Right. And, and you're a stock selector and you look at businesses and you see on the ground what's changing, but the narrative was that the Fed was going to lower rates and inflation's under control. And this year it does not appear that same narrative is in place and the market has still gone up, which is a little interesting.
Right. But the interesting part is with value, and this is why I'm biased and have strong opinions about it, but it works because there are always sectors that are out of favor that people are afraid of, just like there were in late 1990s with industrial cyclicals. Let me just give you a couple of examples that show how extreme valuations can get. I'm going to use some historical ones, which are already out of our portfolio, so you can sort of see how crazy the world can be. But in the middle of COVID, you could buy GE for $5 a share. This was before it did a reverse split back to 40, but it was $5 a share. And it was because their biggest engine, the biggest business is jet engines. Nobody was traveling. And like 6 months earlier, if you had said you could buy GE for five, when they're the world's largest jet engine manufacturer. So half of every commercial airplane that takes off is powered by a GE engine. And more than half were their market share of new engines was more than half. But you don't make any money when you sell one. You make all the money as it operates, and it goes through spare parts and overhauls, and that's where all the margin is. If you would trust my arithmetic for a minute, and I assumed that air travel never rebounded, never. GE just restructured its operations to live with a revenue that's 60% lower in the jet engine business than it was before. We estimated that GE would make 75 cents a share. So I could make a 15% return forever if nothing ever improved from COVID.
Right.
And if it did improve and you got the margin structure back to where they thought they could get it, which is always optimistic, but that was their plans.
Yeah.
They would earn $2 a share and you'd lock in 40% a year. So if I'm presented with an opportunity, the good outcome, you make 40% a year forever. And the bad outcome is you make 15% a year forever. Why wouldn't you put all your money in that?
That's right. That's right.
Of course, nobody put money in it.
No.
So you get exactly. These skewed outcomes. And that's really what value investing is about, finding things that where the world is just so pessimistic that they can't see it that way. All they can do is read the newspaper.
That's right.
And the newspaper was negative.
Yeah.
Obviously, nobody's flying. GE's losing money. They have debt. They're laying off people. This is all the things that are happening at the time.
Right. And so today we have this situation where it's a little bit opposite. It does appear that things can't get any better. And investors have been chasing one area of the market, this large cap and Mag 7 S&P type market. And that must have just, you know, left large swaths of stocks underappreciated in this right now.
It did. Yes, yeah. It did.
Yeah.
And, you know, they range from things that there's always a reason, right? So here's a good example today, and it's not even tech related. So we don't even have to get into AI and all of that.
Right.
But we do know all these anti-obesity drugs, the GLP-1s, which has propelled like Eli Lilly into a mag contender.
Can I stop you there for just 1 second? I want to add on about how popular these drugs are. I just went to my daughter's college parents weekend, and I talked to a doctor friend of mine there, and he said that he could put me on Ozempic. And I kind of said, wow, I must be looking kind of bad, but it is prolific.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. So you can imagine how the stocks of companies that, I'll just give you one example, kidney dialysis companies, when there's a study that gets published that says Ozempic can lower the incidence of kidney failure. And of course, these stocks get annihilated when that happens.
Right.
And so when you go to visit their CEOs, they say a few things. One is, it's not clear that, first of all, you have to die of something. So if widespread use of GLP-1s, of Ozempic, it becomes pervasive, and you're not fat, and you therefore don't die from heart disease, the odds are actually higher that you're going to die from kidney disease, not lower. And second of all, we won't know for 15 years anyway.
That's right.
So in that 15 years, we're going to make way more money than what you're paying to buy the company. So it's like a no-brainer to own that, even though it sounds terrible, right?
Yeah. And so that kind of logic that the market makes and says, hey, Ozempic's going to lower kidney failure, therefore we don't want any dialysis companies. That kind of logic, I call it kind of like they're playing checkers, right? They listen to the headline, the lead story, and there's no chess-like thinking, which is what is two or three moves down the road, right? And that's interesting logic that you just applied there, that maybe they need it more because they're going to live longer, right?
Yes.
and therefore there's more chance they'll die. So I think that's kind of gets lost in these bull markets because people,
it does.
They don't even think through things anymore. They just follow headlines. Like another, you know, way of looking at this AI cloud revolution, which is very similar to the internet thing. You know, the internet's still around. We use it all the time. It's just that the same businesses are not the ones that are the leaders, and it's not as profitable. And so now we have this AI thing. But what's common through all of these technological advancements, even in medicine, is it helps the businesses that are getting left behind. The users of the technology are all of these value companies that need help in their earnings margins.
And by the way, that's what you saw during the internet. Let's just pick one that everybody knows, Caterpillar tractor.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, you could have bought a Taiwanese tractor for 40% less than a Caterpillar tractor. And guess what happened? Caterpillar used the internet to strengthen its position. And so this whole idea that the new entrant always wins and the incumbent always loses every time there's a new technology is not consistent with history. History is, if you have a good franchise and someone comes up with a tool that you have to pay for, but that the value of the tool is that it lowers your overall operating costs, those that have dominant franchises are going to be beneficiaries, not losers.
Yeah, absolutely. So one more point on this sort of large areas of the market maybe being left behind here and an ultra focus on a few stocks and keeping up. So how would you compare the valuations that you're seeing today to other points in history of your opportunity set of stocks you look at?
Well, the valuations that we're seeing today are very normal. Okay. I would use that word. The valuations relative to the market are wide, the spreads are wide, but the absolute levels of valuation, we use a term in our own firm normal earnings. So like, for example, I used the GE example before. There weren't normal what was going on during COVID. So normal, you might not know exactly what the size of GE would be in a recovery, but you know that for the industry leader to be losing a few billion dollars a year is not normal. It's not likely to sustain.
Right.
So our price, our range that we buy stocks at relative to their normal level of earnings runs between 5 times and 10 times over history. And we're right in the middle. We get the extremes were like in the middle of the financial crisis, in the middle of the COVID crisis. That's where you can get things at 5 times. Today, you really can't.
Right.
But 7.5 times, if you think of that as a 15% yield or a 14% yield, earnings yield, that's pretty good in a 5% interest rate environment, 5% long bond, right. 4% long bond environment. And if you looked at a long history, this is even now just looking at data, but going back 100 years, if you looked at the PE ratio of the cheapest stocks over 100 years, it's basically a flat line. I mean, it wiggles, but it's a flat line. And if you look at the PE stock of the market, it's like that. So,
right.
So this
just
gap has gotten
really
wide. So it's not, I think it was wider in the middle of the internet bubble than it is today. But nevertheless, it's wider than most points in history today.
Yeah. And you know, in the bond market, I mean, people talk about the option adjusted spread or the yields over treasuries. And this is sort of a reverse of that, is you have these companies that everybody wants to own. And in particular, when you said normalized earnings, you know, if you do a normalized like PE 10 on the S&P 500, you're talking about a PE of close to 30. And so you're talking about a PE of close to 30 up there, and you're finding stocks in the PEs of 7 sort of.
Yes. Way. Yes. And that's a giant difference. Yes.
It's a giant difference. And so if you were a high yield bond investor, you would be gobbling those up, right?
Yes.
You'd be like, I want all those I can get.
Correct.
And it's funny how in the stock market, there's such a trend that people just have to be on the train until the train starts going off the cliff, and then they discover the value elsewhere, right?
You know, and I used the GE example, and GE was for several decades was the company with the highest market cap of any company in the world.
I know, that was incredible, right?
Yeah.
And now it's not even anybody.
Yeah, it's not even remotely close.
And in fact, it's very hard to even read an article that's not about NVIDIA. It's funny. You can't find any research on anything other than 7 stocks, which is just, you know, maybe why we're having this conversation, because I just think the timing is good, right?
It is.
And so you did talk a little bit about some of the characteristics that you look for in a stock. How about breaking down, like, what would an ideal stock look like for you?
Well, look, ideal is a company that has a dominant franchise where something has gone wrong. You have to accept that part of it, because I've been explaining what I do for 40 years, but I've also sat on investment committees and listened to other people explain what they do. And it boils down to one sentence. Everybody says exactly the same thing. We buy good businesses for low prices. That's our investment approach. The problem is that good businesses don't sell for low prices. And I've been looking for 40 years and I've never found one, because we all describe good businesses the same way. You know, companies that have attractive growth prospects and a dominant franchise and a giant moat protecting them from competitors and high margins and a strong management team and clean balance sheet. Why would any of that ever sell for a low price? It just doesn't.
My college professor used to call that good luck finding the perfect stock.
Right. So you have to, you have to do one of two things. You have to pay up and hope that things turn out better than everybody thinks, or you have to forego one or more of the aspects of quality that you're looking for. Now, fortunately, there are good businesses that make mistakes or something happens that gets them in trouble. And the pattern is like this. Companies' earnings are chugging along, doing just fine. Something happens and they fall off of that long-term trend. And the market can react negatively, sometimes precipitously so. And the problems are not always permanent. So GE is a good example of that. You know, they're chugging along in their jet engine business. COVID hits. Everybody stops flying. The airplanes get parked. The maintenance revenues go to zero, basically. And everybody cancels their orders for new jet engines. So does that mean it's a bad business? Well, it's bad right now.
That's right.
But if you listen to the characteristics, I mean, a 50% market share, it's a giant fixed cost to develop a new jet engine. So if you have a 50% market share and your next closest competitor is 25, you get to amortize that same cost over twice as many engines. And therefore, it's impossible for the number two player to have your margin structure. Right. And in the engine business, there's only three in the whole world. And the number three is Rolls-Royce, and they've been flirting in and out of bankruptcy for decades. This is about as good of a business as you can imagine. And for, I don't know, 60 years, travel has grown faster than GDP. The more money people have and the more wealth they have, the more they want to travel. And so, you know, you don't even have to make stuff up. It's happening.
Right. So that's an interesting thing that you said there. You know, your businesses are impaired in some way temporarily. And the market views that temporary, they don't even really care about what's happening.
Right.
They just see the earnings go down and they just get me out. But
correct.
In theory, what they're saying is whatever's happening in the short run is permanent, right?
Right.
And the opposite of that would be where you'd make mistakes is probably buying companies with perfect earnings, right? And so I think it's what's really interesting is that, you know, people use this, you know, they want to buy businesses with really good earnings, as opposed to what I think about it is I want to buy a really good business with bad earnings.
Yes, correct.
Right.
Correct. Yeah. So for us, you know, look, identifying these companies is very easy to do. There's no rocket science and it's very easy. The hard part is making the judgment. Are the businesses any good? Are the problems temporary and not permanent? Is it rational to believe that the company can restore its earnings back to their historic norms? And of course, you don't know for sure the answers to those questions. And the more uncertainty there is about the future, the cheaper the stock gets. And sometimes it gets to the point that a GE got to, which is even in the bad case, you're going to make money.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen that often. So I'm not trying to say that you're going to find millions of those.
Yeah.
But you can find a lot of companies where the outcomes are skewed in your favor, meaning if the management succeeds with its business plan, you make a lot of money. And if they fail, you don't lose a lot. So that if you're 50-50, and I think if you lay it out in these simple terms, if I give you a 50% chance of doubling your money and a 50% chance of losing 25, would you take that bet?
Yeah.
And I'd want
as many
long.
Of those bets. Yeah. I'd want as many of them as possible.
Correct.
Right.
And if you can get 20 or 30 or 40 of them, so what if half of them go wrong?
Exactly. Well, let's add on to that. So are you finding a lot of good opportunities today?
We are.
Yeah. Yeah. And
we are.
And do you find yourself alone in thinking these are great opportunities, or are there a lot of folks moving in?
No, there's our crowd of people that do what we do.
Yeah.
And there's others who just can't stomach the risk as they see it, right? They
today.
They don't know how to
the risk they see today.
Risk. Yeah.
Yeah.
They,
yeah.
Right. They, so it's, and I view it as what we're doing is easier than what other people are doing. I mean, we only have to be 50-50 on getting it right. To buy the Mag 7, you got to be 100%. Because if half of those go down, they're going down by way more than the one the other half are going to go up by.
And let's talk about that then, because the Mag 7 has pulled up the popularity of the S&P 500 and you know, indexing hasn't been, I mean, indexing is incredibly popular today. I believe that over 50% of the dollars in the market are now rules-based investing. And I think people need to understand how the weighting works in an index, right? I think they forget this. So if seven companies are 30, if seven companies perform so well, they can become 32% of
right.
the index.
Let me tell you the last group that was 32% of the index, because when I started my career in 1980, I graduated from college. Energy, oil stocks were 32% of the S&P 500. Exxon was the biggest cap company in the world at the time. And that's because we were going to run out of oil. These guys were going to print money. And people valued them. And if you bought the S&P 500 in 1980, you would have gotten annihilated, because that 32% today is like 5%.
It's very interesting you referenced that. I was talking to another portfolio manager that referenced exactly that example. And you know, I was 10 years old at the time, so I don't really remember that. but that's extremely interesting. And so I think that the part that people are missing about it being 32% of the index is not necessarily that those players are, I feel like they, I guess they think those the players that are ruling the index today are going to be there tomorrow, but that part's has not, you know, buying the largest stocks in the universe has never been a good idea. But where it creates risk is it only takes a couple of hiccups in those stocks to ruin the whole index.
It does. Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And you're putting a lot of faith in those stocks, and it's the faith that everybody is putting in. So that's what compounds it. That's why their caps are big.
Yeah, you're just running with the herd at that point.
Yeah,
and the train is moving fast, and at some point you have to step away from the herd because it might be going off a cliff, right? Yeah,
you know. And this, by the way, this comes up like in a sophisticated institutional client discussions as well, of people, you know, that are managing hundreds of billions of dollars. You can't get away from a discussion of the Mag 7 there as well. And so I said, look, if you're so worried about it, just set up a Mag 7 portfolio, put whatever money you want to put in that. Don't pay money managers to buy the Mag 7 for you.
Yeah.
Because what do they know? They're just riding the wave. You don't have to pay them.
Yeah.
And then use your money, the rest of the money, to buy interesting stuff.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I think that's a great way of looking at it. I've sort of gotten to the point with a few conversations where I was saying, well, look, if you want us to go out and buy the NASDAQ, why don't you go out and buy it?
Right.
And they go, no, I don't want to buy it. It's like, well, what makes you think I want to buy it?
Right.
Right. So I think another interesting point about active management, you know, people say, well, active managers can't keep up in this environment. But the technical reason of why they can't keep up is I don't think any active manager worth their salt is going to put 30% of their money in 10 stocks.
Correct.
I mean, correct. I don't even think diversification rules allow for that.
Right. Right.
All right. So maybe we've beaten up the index a bit. I always like to beat the index up a bit in every call. You know, I do favor people who've been managing money for a long time and try to select securities on the behalf of the clients and for their benefit. So speaking about sort of this index weighting thing, and then how, you know, once you find stocks, you have a very interesting way of weighting stocks in your portfolio. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Look, for us, generally speaking, we're building concentrated portfolios. So in the U.S. large cap portfolio that dates back to the beginning of our firm, it's a 30 to 40 stock portfolio. That means the average position size is 2.5 to 3%. So what do you do when you find a GE? When you say, wow, I think I'm going to make money in my downside case. So we have a we constrain it to 5% of the portfolio at the time of purchase. So nothing can be more than 5%. We'll let it ride in the good outcome where we get it right and it starts going up. We'll let it ride to be up to 7.5% before we automatically trim it back. But for us, our weightings are based on one, how cheap is it? So the cheaper it is, the bigger the weighting. So as it runs up, it's getting less cheap. And therefore, you want it to be smaller, not bigger. And yet it's getting bigger. So you balance it and you trim. Second, we kind of look more for industry confirmation than we do for outliers, meaning, you know, I don't want to use GE because there are only three such companies in the business. But if you were buying retailers, let's say, and they're a dime a dozen, and a bunch of them were 20 times earnings, and you found one at 8 times earnings, it's not necessarily the right move because there could be something massively wrong with that. But if they were all 8 times earnings, then you'd want to find the best ones because you understand that they're out of favor. People are just afraid of the environment. And if you can find good ones, then you own them. So what we do is industry confirmation increases our confidence and wants us to buy more rather than find outliers. And third is how much do you know? Do you really know what you're talking about? Or when we say it more scientifically, how skewed are the outcomes? Meaning, if the downside case is that the company could go bankrupt versus a downside case in GE where the world couldn't survive without GE's manufacturing capability, those are two totally different things.
Right.
I mean, if the Gap stores went bankrupt, it wouldn't be the end of the world. If GE did, it would be. Right. So there's a different risk-reward trade-off on those kinds of things.
So what you just explained, the cheaper and more you like a stock, you own it more in the portfolio.
Yes.
You have industry confirmation that you're in an out-of-favor space, not buying the worst stock in a great industry.
Right.
And then your sort of risk metric of what's my downside is so intuitive. It's just so logical. You think everybody would weight their portfolio that way. But of course, here's the punchline is that today, when everybody's trying to keep up with indexing, they're doing the exact opposite of that.
Yeah. Look, people have metrics and you know, our profession has institutionalized these metrics for risk that make no sense whatsoever.
We use
two kind common risk metrics. One is how volatile is the portfolio?
Yeah.
And two, how different is it than the index?
Exactly.
And so, you know, the first time I really heard this in a professional setting was some client said to us, "You think the market is really expensive, and so do we. And you have really high tracking error. So you're taking on a lot of risk." So I'm saying, so you think the market is expensive and you want me to buy more of it. That's what you're suggesting. And, you know, you think, really? That's what you do in that situation?
It's exactly right. When all these managers are trying to beat benchmarks or have structured portfolios that are designed to outperform a specific benchmark, they have to match almost the stock weighting. So the bigger the stock,
right,
they own. The more it goes up, the more they own.
Right. And they should be doing the opposite. Really?
The bigger the industry, the more they own.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yes. and their risk metric is how far different are you than that thing which Correct. You don't even want to own.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm glad we uncovered that. It's like an interesting phenomenon. So one final question for you. This is probably the point where our listeners are falling asleep. They're not falling asleep, but maybe they're getting to their destination in their car or whatever. But I think the last question I want to ask of you is so when you manage domestic and international portfolio, what is the relative valuation difference that you're seeing between domestic, international, and EM?
Well, there's gigantic differences, and the most striking is China. So China's the cheapest place in the world to invest right now. And you can Google is China investable, and you'll see article after article after article saying China is uninvestable because you have no idea what's going to happen there and it's just too risky. And the reality is you have no idea what's going to happen anywhere. And you know, I'll use my 1980 oil industry example to say, you know, people think the U.S. is safe, China's not. So in 1980 or 81, I can't remember what year it happened, when oil prices skyrocketed, the equivalent of over $100 a barrel today, the U.S. government passed the windfall profits tax and confiscated, I think it was a 70% tax rate on any money that you might made over $30 a barrel. Okay, they just took it, right? And we like to think that the U.S. doesn't do that.
That's incredible insight. I had no idea they did that.
Yeah. So governments do what governments do.
Yeah.
And the idea that you know which government is going to act against you is crazy. So if I can pay, you know, low single digit multiples of earnings rather than 30 times earnings, I want to skew more of my investment into those kinds of markets. So EM is the cheapest place, led by China. Europe is probably second because Europe's economy, proximity to Russia and the Ukraine war and the energy crisis that presumes, and policies that have been less business friendly over the years has led to better valuations. And what's interesting is companies are global and they sell into all these markets. And so if you get the same company, one headquartered in the US and one headquartered in the Europe, and they have the exact same business mix, you pay a cheaper price for the one that's headquartered in Europe.
It's incredible to me because there's actually a lot of businesses in Europe that look very similar to US businesses.
Yes.
Yeah. And they might be selling 70% of their products into the US.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I get it. All right. So we've kind of, I think we've talked about a lot of different things here. I think I just really want to thank you for your wisdom and your experience and sharing just what you shared with us. I will say that I don't think there's an index that does what you do. if you would like, specific value investing, then this style is not available to you in an index. Secondly, that, you know, you really do represent what we look for in investment manager, being I boil it down to independent experience specialist. And I think you and your firm represent that very well.
Yeah. Look, and the truth is, this is the only thing we know how to do, so we don't deviate from it. And over the years, it's paid dividends. And there are times when other things are better. There are times when other things are worse. But this is a pretty tried and true method for having what I'll call good returns over the long term. So I'm obviously a believer and I live it every day of my life. So thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks. That was fun. And look forward to doing it maybe again next year.
This podcast is for informational purposes only. The information does not constitute advice or a recommendation of any specific investment, mutual fund, or mutual fund company. Before making any investment, you should carefully seek independent legal, tax, and regulatory advice. In particular, you should seek the advice of a licensed financial advisor regarding the suitability of the investment product, taking into account your specific investment objectives, financial situation, any particular needs, and your ability to assume the risk and fees involved before investing. This podcast and presentation are for informational purposes only. Frontier assumes no liability for any action taken in response to listening to this podcast. Frontier Asset Management is not affiliated with any specific fund company. The views and opinions expressed by each speaker are their own as of the date of the recording. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market and other conditions, and Frontier disclaims any responsibility to update such views.